Committee on Education Subcommittee for this day. What is today? Thursday, April 14th. And Mr. Bender, you have some comments you'd like to make on where we're going today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today is the final day of Phase 2 presentations for the Community College and Workforce Development Department. And I just wanted to point out some materials that you have in front of you here. If you could please note, you did receive a set of responses from the department to some questions that you had yesterday, and I suspect that that'll be the first thing that they'll want to talk about when they get up here. And then you'll notice a couple of other items of information below that. There's a long sheet here, which is your priority list. This is the program priority list that you developed during the Phase 1 process. And part of the Phase 2 process is for the agency to respond to your prioritization order and just to make any comments that they have as to what you've done. Also, when we get to this point, I do want to mention something that the co-chairs requested in terms of breaking out an additional program from this list. Then there is this is a reminder of the performance measure changes that the co-chairs requested that you review, because that will also be part of the discussion today. And then finally, there's a listing of compensation in terms of salary and benefits for each of the agency's employees. This was requested. I know that you've been getting this in a nicer format for some of your smaller agencies. I apologize. I've not had time to do that overnight because you just have to hand enter everything. So I'll try to get that to you as soon as I can. But that was information that was requested on the salary and benefits of the employees of the department.
Okay, very good. Any questions from the committee? Everybody up to date to where we're at? Cam, do you want to come up and discuss some of the questions, or I guess follow-up questions from Phase 2 of the Day 2 hearings?
Thank you.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee and Chair Nelson. I'm Cam Croy Sprawley. I'm the Commissioner for Community Colleges, the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. You should have in front of you, as Steve indicated, responses to questions from yesterday. We have tried to arrange them thematically, and not necessarily in the order in which they were asked. I'll begin with Representative Wisnett requested clarification about the dollar amounts in the administration for national emergency grants. We have gone back to almost to the beginning of the 2003-2005 and a little before that biennium to show you the resources that have come to the department, what the allocation from the Federal Department of Labor was, what our administration was, and what that percentage is. It is in a rule, probably published in the Federal Register, that when a state receives a national emergency grant, the maximum that a state can receive is $25,000 to administer that grant. And otherwise, it is a proportion or a percentage share. So that's why you see the varying amounts. And we never did reach the $25,000, even for our largest grant of $5 million. Just so you know, that's just one of their rules. I would say, since we haven't had much opportunity to discuss the decision in the 03 session to allow the department to move ahead and apply for national emergency grants without first proceeding to the emergency board because of timing issues. Often we would learn of a closure and be able to craft an emergency grant application in less than a month's time, and having to quarterly hold that until a quarterly emergency board sometimes put service delivery to those affected workers on a slow track. So we much appreciate the legislative leadership allowing us the flexibility to move ahead. As you can see, more than $30 million has come to the state to serve those workers, and we appreciate your extension of flexibility to the department. The second question was around enrollment. Senator Devlin requested variations. What's it look like over the last three biennium? We have attached a chart for reimbursable full-time equivalents for the last three biennium, indicating by shadings where there have been losses, both by college and by year. Questions, I'll move on. There was a question from Senator Wistett about the loss of life skill type courses through the loss of course sections. We were able to discern that 17% or 52 sections over the last 3 years have been in that particular area. Representative March asked about adjunct faculty receiving unemployment insurance, we have an explanation there about to qualify for unemployment insurance. Without proceeding to ask each college to respond to this question, we tried to provide you more of a global response. Some are self-insured, some pay as you go. This is the, a context for how unemployment insurance is provided to faculty.
Thanks.
Is that sufficient? Okay. Tuition was the next question. Representative Wisnett requested the range of tuition. And I think this information that you see on the bottom of page three is probably about... it's less than a month old, so it's fairly fresh information about tuition rates.
Sure.
Representative Woodley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for that, and I don't want you to do any work tonight, but do you just know what the state of Washington, what is their average tuition?
Mm-hmm. Chair Nelson, Representative Woodley, I do not, but I can certainly get that information fairly quickly.
Thank you.
Right. In the slides that we presented yesterday, we gave you a full-time equivalent tuition for the state of Washington. Bill just showed it to me. There it is. It's $2,457 for last year, $2,457 for full-time, but I don't know what that equates to credit hour cost.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-enrollment, question from Senator Whitsitt about what appeared to be a slow start for the University of Oregon and Western Oregon University in the development of co-enrollment programs. There has been a commitment by the university system and the community colleges that we would have co-enrollment at the beginning of this coming fall term, and we are proceeding to make that happen.
Did you miss six?
Oh, I did. I'm sorry. Thank you. Nice to have a prompter. Distance learning. Representative Jensen posed a question about would Oregon lose students to other states through its disinvestment by virtue of the expansion of distance learning programs in other states. What we tried to do is just take a quick look at those colleges around the country who do a considerable amount of distance learning, and we're able to find what their per credit cost was, even though we believe that Oregon's tuition is for community colleges bordering on unaffordable, certainly the cost per credit that you see here would make it look very affordable. Just from the very first one, the virtual in Michigan at $215 per credit.
Just a observation. Since we had talked about Dallas being one of the ones, I know that's one you didn't include. I hope there's nothing. Okay.
Yes, I would say that these were the ones that we could find quickly in an internet search. So if you would like for us to bring back specifically information on Dallas Community College, we can do that.
Right.
Okay.
If I may.
Sure, yes.
Are we marketing out-of-state at out-of-state tuition, or are we marketing out-of-state at in-state tuition?
Chair Nelson, Representative Jensen, we do have a reciprocity agreement for the border states of Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and to some extent California, where those residents can attend college in Oregon and be reimbursed. And the tuition is... the tuition rates are set by the local boards, and in some places, those same students are charged out-of-state tuition, and in some cases, they are not, depending on the situation.
So that's a local board decision whether we're going to charge out-of-state?
Chair Nelson, Representative Jensen, absolutely. It's a local board decision. And for distance learning, the same would follow for both on-site and distance learning courses.
I don't see, of course, much difference between Washington, Oregon, or Washington, Idaho, as two border states, and Texas or South Carolina or wherever, at least in this type of education. It has, as a matter of fact, I think... Blue Mountain at one time had a student from Israel, and I suspect other community colleges have some of these. This idea of in thinking about this type of education delivery, boundaries, state boundaries or distance is not really a significant factor, I don't think. And it's something we'll probably, as this technology increases, improve, we'll deal a lot more with some of the complexities of that. But it's not terribly important in our discussion here, and so I'll leave it alone and we'll go on.
Any further questions? Please, where are we? Remember how we had, we're done with six now?
Yes, I believe we are.
Yes.
Okay. And we have covered seven. Senator Devlin and Senator Whitsitt asked yesterday if it was possible to receive an Associate of Arts degree online, and it is available online. And we have given you this morning, the colorful brochure, Spring of 2005, which lays out the course offerings across the state.
Mr. Representative Jensen?
Just as a kind of a follow-up on this issue, do we have online labs? As some of the science courses do, I think, some of the science requirements require lab science type of thing. What do we do in those cases, just for our information?
Chair Nelson, Representative Jensen, generally, I can't speak specifically, but generally an online course may have one or two physical meetings when it requires a lab. I'm thinking specifically of the prerequisites for allied health programs, that most of the delivery can be by distance. And it may be a Saturday or two that the class is brought to a physical location to do required lab work. So that is at least my anecdote experience to share.
Are the science instructors comfortable with this?
Chair Nelson, Representative Jensen, I can assume they are, as they are the instructors for the coursework. And it has followed through course approval processes within the college and for programs to the state level for approval.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to be appear to be argumentative with this, but it strikes me that the science instructors are given courses and responsibilities by the administration, and whether they're comfortable sometimes with what they are asked to do or not is not, I mean, the fact they're doing it does not necessarily indicate their level of comfort.
Certainly.
In the courses. And I don't wish this question to appear to be something of a badgering or what have you of the colleges or of the administration. It's just a question that I think in distance education needs to be carefully looked at. If my familiarity with science instructors is carrying on to science instructors of this era, sort of thing. So, and I appreciate, you know, that's always was, you know, for us in back in the dark ages when we were getting started on some of these things, that was always one of the problems in looking at trying to get a degree, sort of thing, was that one of the big hang-ups was always the lab courses, mm-hmm. science lab courses, and I suspect we'll continue to be in some ways be that, and we may be having to rethink some of those issues. I'd be interested in more information on that, but I don't know that it's germane to the Ways and Means process here.
Chair Nelson, Representative Jensen, we'll follow up with you independently on this question. I appreciate you raising it.
Number nine,
PERS and health care. Senator Whitsitt, with the calculator in his head, figured a 3% increase in health care yesterday, on reflected in the bar chart that we showed. And I might ask Mr. Bender to help me on this, because we worked collaboratively on gathering that information. What the essential budget level shows is actually a zero increase in both of the years, because that's what the state of Oregon figures on the essential budget level. Am I so far correct?
Mr. Chair and members, the numbers that were presented, the that showed the increase of, I think it was 3% per year, was, although they showed that as being the forecast health care, health insurance premiums for 2005-2007, actually that was a number that we had asked, or we're looking into. It wasn't representing the actual projected 2005-2007 health insurance premiums, but instead reflected a projection of what health premium costs would be if they remained at the current year level for both years of the upcoming biennium. So basically, if they stayed flat at the current year level for the next 2 years, the projection is that the colleges would pay $91.8 million for premiums for health insurance for their employees. And the reason why we asked for that particular number is for state employees, community college employees, of course, not state employees, but for state employees, within the calculation of the base or essential budget level, there is that type of roll-up where the current level of health insurance premiums are brought forward to the next biennium at the current rates. And we were interested in figuring out what the comparable number would be for community college employees. And we ended up using that number to discuss with the co-chairs certain costs increases that they might want to consider looking at for community colleges. And they eventually did do that. But the number, the $91.8 million, was not actually meant to be a projection of what actual upcoming biennium health insurance premiums would be.
Yes. Does Mr. Bender have an approximation of what that
the actual number is going to be no. We do not have that. And the department, in their response to you, is indicating that they are preparing that and will be bringing that back to the committee. But we do not have, LFO does not have a separate projection for that either.
Seems to be rather a large hole in the budget, then, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a large increase that we don't have a projected number for.
That's right. And if I'm right on that slide that we shared yesterday, we did reflect the projected increase in PERS costs, but we did not have a projected increase in health insurance costs, which, as Mr. Bender has indicated, we expect to bring back to you. Right now, we know that the range is somewhere between 10 and 17% across the 17 colleges, but we'll bring back more specific information when we return.
So we could approximate, Mr. Chair, that we could approximate that then by dividing the 91 million, 9.1 million by 0.9 or 0.88, somewhere in that ballpark, we get an idea of what that figure would be then.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I actually think that the number will be larger than the 91 million. I think that's the expecting it to be flat when in fact it is not.
No, well, if you divide it by 0.88, you get a bigger figure.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Gordley is now.
He's now the chair.
Good morning.
Welcome, Chair Gordley.
And please continue.
We're just finishing the last response. There were some questions yesterday that will take some additional research, and the Senator Devlin asked what has been the rate of full-time to part-time to adjunct over the last three bienniums, and Representative Jensen asked which colleges pooled for insurance and which were independent. What we would appreciate doing is adding that information to the letter that came from Chair Devlin, which had a number of questions about faculty ratios and insurance coverage and things of that ilk. So we would like to roll those together and bring those back for you at the latest. It will be next Friday, the 22nd, if that's agreeable.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Additional questions?
Okay. And where would you like to go next?
I would like to start and walk through day three's presentation, if that suits the committee. Mr. Bender did talk about both performance measures and program priorities. My question is, do you want to do that first, or shall we run through our slides and then do that information?
Why don't we go through the slides?
Okay. Members of the committee, today we are going to be talking about the budget detail. Yesterday morning, both Mr. Bender and Mr. McGee gave you a high-level walkthrough of the department's budget. We're going to go a little deeper. Some of this information should be familiar. We're going to start with revenue for 2005-07. You will see that just a little over 25% of the department's budget is federal funds, about 2.5% is other funds, and nearly 72% of our revenue is a general fund.
Please continue.
Page for you,
I'm on page 3 of the handouts. Okay. I do want to remind the committee that the 25% of funds that are federal do come with strings. There are target populations. There are target services. There are federally required performance measures, and there are federally required auditing and program monitoring that goes with that 25% of the funds. Slide 4 is expenditures for 2005-07. This looks fairly much the same because most all of our programs, both federal and state, are fully expended each biennium. Wanted to remind the committee that the department actually passes through more than 97% of the funds that we receive, both federal, other, and state. It leaves the department to fund 7 workforce areas, 17 community colleges, and adult literacy services, as well as every county in the state has a Oregon Youth Conservation Corps program. Office operations comprises technical assistance, resource and expenditure fiduciary responsibilities, and statewide leadership for both community college and workforce development, and that's at about 1.9%. 2.2% of the $6 million that you see, I should back up, you see an office operation of $12 million. Of that $12 million, six of it moves directly to the field for the Employer Workforce Training Fund, and the rest of it supports the office operations. Slide 5 is a 3 biennium budget overview. We wanted to go back and look at, have a picture of the general fund, other fund, and federal fund reductions that have happened both within the department and for the support fund. So you will notice that the bottom line is that total budget cuts in the last 3 biennium have been over $100 million. I would be quick to note that $55 million of that is the delayed 8th payment for community colleges that was approved in the third special session of the 2001-03 biennium, bringing the actual reduction to about $60 million. Or with that, we'd still have a reduction.
I would just say here that having participated, most of us, in the full Ways and Means meeting at Portland Community College last evening, and hearing all of the excellent testimony, and particularly testimony from those who came to share their experiences with community colleges, and those who also wanted to share what has been the impact of the cuts, hearing the number again and looking at the number again and putting that together with real live experience is rather daunting and very, very compelling.
Thank you, Chair Courtley. We're going to move on to the budget structure of the agency. We have 10 areas that we're going to cover. We'll just start right in with the Community College Support Fund. A reminder that community colleges receive approximately half of their revenue support through the department, and that comes from the state general fund. That, as I just indicated, that general fund allocation has declined $62 million since the beginning of the 2001 biennium. Those lost state resources have, in fact, led to a loss of affordability, a loss of capacity, and a loss of access. Slide 8 is a bar graph that depicts from the 99 01 adopted budget to the governor's recommended budget, what state funding for our community colleges looks like. And this is just the general fund for community colleges. It does not include office operations. On slide 9, we want to acknowledge that the current situation where we have a restoration proposed by the governor, and both the House and the Senate have proposed increases, and we have those numbers in parentheses as understanding that it is will be approximately $416 million for the Community College Support Fund at a level of $421.5 million for the overall general fund for the department because of that portion that goes to support both debt service and office operations. Just so we're, when we're, because we're talking about both the general fund and that subset, and granted it's a major subset, the majority subset of the general fund is the support fund for the community colleges. Want to make sure that we're
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the previous slide, you're using the 0103 adopted number. And in reality, we never got there. What's the actual number? I assume this is the this is end of session adopted number, and then we had the five not so special sessions.
That's how I describe it.
Very good, very good.
So, I'm sure it's here somewhere, but
it's also in this.
Okay,
thing
great, right. Thank you.
Yes, Chair right. Gordley, Representative March, I was going to point you to Steve's chart because he does. Show the $438 million, which is inclusive of the bird payment. I'm going to move to slide 10, which is federal and other support revenue and expenditure. We have combined these slides because we are required by the federal government to expend these dollars on an annual basis. We do have opportunity to spend them over multiple years, but it is their expectation that most of it would be spent in the year in which it is allocated. From this, you can see that our Federal Workforce Investment Act dollars make up almost 84% of the federal dollars that we receive. Adult basic ed is a little over 7%. Carl Perkins is 6%. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps is 1.4%. Other funds is a little over 0.5%, and GED revenue is also about 0.5%. In case you couldn't read all those little lines on the pie. Debt service. We currently have. I'm sorry,
Senator. What's it?
Chair Gurley, Ms. Trestberry, where is the property tax accounted for here? Do you have a property tax revenue?
Chair Gordley, Senator Whitsitt, we do not. We have, in the overall budget that Legislative Fiscal Office and the Governor's Office prepare, it is included, the projected property tax for the upcoming biennium is included in that budget as total state resources for support of community colleges, but we haven't pulled it out in our presentation.
So is that included in the general fund?
Mr. McGee?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, those revenues are never received by the state, so they're not expended by the state, so you won't see that in state budget information. They're received directly by the colleges and expended by the colleges. So we show it to you and use it in calculations, but you'll never see that running through the state budget.
Mm-hmm. So now it just seems it should be reflected in your comments here. How much is it?
Senator Whitsitt, we're projecting $220 million property taxes at the for the community colleges next biennium, from up from about $200 million this biennium.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yes, ma'am.
Please continue.
I was on slide 11, discussion of debt service. We have currently for the 05-07 a little over $2.2 million of debt service to retire some bonds that were purchased, I believe, in the late 80s, actually refinanced in the late 80s. The good news is that this particular debt service will retire in the next biennium. And in Senate Bill 5514, there, if that bill passes as it has been written, there will be six community colleges who would be part of, which would be supported by debt service. In the governor's recommended budget, there is not anticipated to be additional debt in 05-07 for the sale of those bonds, because it is anticipated that they would be sold late in the biennium and any principal or interest payments would begin in actually after July of 07.
Mr. Bender has a comment as well.
Yes, so that what the commissioner said is correct. If you do approve the capital construction projects for community colleges, there would be no additional debt service in 05-07. We're projecting that the increase in debt service beginning in 07-09, when it would start to be, you know, payable, would be approximately $13 million per biennium. $13 million.
That's at the six projects?
Correct.
Right.
Madam Chair.
A Representative Wisnack.
Thank you. Mr. Bender, do you know what the debt service would be for all the projects on the drawing board?
I do not. I can look at that. I need a list of the prices of all the projects. And
Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Wisnett, when we originally did the research, we believe it will be somewhere, if all 18 or all 17, suddenly a new college, all 17 colleges received state bonds, it would be somewhere about $18 million. But, well,
no.
Please continue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
One follow-up. So it's only, so if we delay that decision 2 years, 4 years, that's probably going to go up significantly with the interest rates. The bond, my point is the bonds are so cheap, are a lot cheaper now than we anticipate in the future. Is that a correct analysis? Or? Mr. Bender?
Well, interest rates are pretty low right now, you're correct, in historic levels. I don't think we really have a formal projection of what interest rates will be 2 years from now or 4 years from now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnott. What's it? That was a late night.
I think that, to follow up on what Colonel Wisnott was saying, is that I think it's really important that we have a projection, and I know you don't know what these interest rates will be, but you could probably surmise a guess, and also on the other end of it, what the construction cost, the difference in the construction cost might be from waiting, and I think both the interest rates going up and the construction cost going up could be a significant factor in our decision.
Thank you. I'm on slide 12. We're going to talk about the office operations program unit in the budget. As I indicated earlier, the department has 1.9% of all resources for administration. We like to think we are lean and mean. The governor's recommended budget does include 48 positions, 46 full-time equivalents. We do have staff that all staff charge their time as appropriate to federal funds and other funds or general funds. And we have a slide here, and you should have a slide in your packets that's multicolored. What we have attempted to do is to illustrate how the department leverages the use of federal, general, and other funds to accomplish our mission of service to Oregonians. This chart does reflect staffing patterns for each fund source. Each of these colors is reflective of a funding stream, it's not necessarily reflective of a specific proportion or percentage of time. Let's take me, for example, since I have an easy title to find on this chart. I charge my time to General Fund, to the Workforce Investment Act, and to Carl Perkins. And it's not a simple one-third, one-third, one-third split as the chart would show you. We're a little bit hampered by our technology here. I do charge more of my time to General Fund because I spend more of my time on community college issues than I do federal workforce programs.
I'm sure.
Representative Whitsitt. Senator Whitson, I'll get through the morning with your help.
Can we get you some more coffee, madam?
Thank you, Representative.
Ms. Commissioner, where are the property tax revenues allocated into these formulas?
Senator Gordley, I'm Chair Gordley. Senator Whitson, see, it's catching. Again, this organizational chart does not at all reflect property taxes. As Mr. McGee said, we do not collect them. We don't pass them through, and therefore we don't, if you will, take a cut of property taxes. It is it's a local revenue source.
So all of the property taxes will go directly, not to the department, but directly to that school to be expended in that school.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner and maybe Mr. Bender, we're going to get into more detail, but I really like to get into organizational charts, and I don't understand the assistant commissioner for ops and the assistant commissioner. Is that I don't know who's reporting to who. So, do we going to get that later? I don't want to take up the more detail as far as span of control and span of management control. It looks like we've got a couple of layers of management in there. Are we going to?
Let me see if there's another organization chart that was provided in the governor's recommendation. Was there? Do you know offhand?
Madam Chair, it's hard to follow. You know, there's two assistants. So to me, that looks like a layering of deputy commissioners, and then you've got five different lines down. So normally managers can handle five levels of supervision.
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, as you are describing the organizational chart, you are correct. When I took the commissioner job, I had 8 direct reports. That was too many. I did reorganize the office and moved from 1 deputy to 2. We are organized to integrate the service to the department and to our field with the program aspects. So the assistant commissioner for programs is responsive both to the Assistant Commissioner for Operations and what they need in order to move the money to the local level, as well as for the Assistant Commissioner for Operations to be aware of how fast that money is moving and what auditing and monitoring responsibilities we have and data collection responsibilities we have. We do then have a layer of actual subordinate managers who manage specific programs that are responsive to the to the Assistant Commissioner for Programs.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I don't want to get into going down to detail on this. I'm not sure that's what we're supposed to do, but just, you know, you've got a lot of terms. Principal executive, assistant to the commissioner, and assistant commissioner. Just, I don't know that. And you know, you have reorganized, but you've still got an assistant commissioner in charge of three departments and another one in charge of two, and then under him he's got principal executive. I don't understand. I mean, I don't think my job is to manage your department or your agency, but seems like we have a lot of, you know, titles, and I hope they're necessary or they've been looked at.
Too many colonels?
Yeah. Generals.
Mr. Bender, did you wish to comment?
Well, I just wanted to comment a bit about the titles, and maybe this is all very obvious, and I apologize, but the term, like, principal executive is a term in the state's classification system that a particular position in any particular department may be classified as a principal executive D based on the responsibilities. But the actual, so for example, if you look at the Assistant Commissioner for Operations, they're classified as a manager F. But they really are an assistant commissioner. It's not as if they're two different positions there. So one is just the title that is in the state's classification system, and that determines what the pay rate is. And the other is the actual position in the department and the title of that person in the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That that clarified some of the issues. Still, the only other one I would look at is layering as far as under operations with the agency support manager and the finance and administrative manager, but it looks like that looks a little better, as far as my experience. Thank you.
I would just say, Representative, that your questions are very legitimate. The agency has characterized the administration as lean, and what you're trying to do is get a deeper understanding of what that means. So the questions are very legitimate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've identified that the property tax going to Veresen's Hundred Community College is not part of the budget that we have or that we're looking at here, because principally it doesn't come through. And it's not a pass-through in your operation. When we look at the total amount of money in relationship to community colleges or a particular community college, as the case may be, we also have another significant stream of money in there that doesn't, I don't think, comes through or passes through through the state, and that is the tuition fees, which if we're looking at finding what the local tax dollars are, it would also, at least for me, be helpful to look at the proportion or see a pie chart, if we don't have that someplace else, the amount of tuition, local tax dollars, general fund dollars that go in to the overall operation of community colleges. I mean, and I'm not trying to defend the increase in fees or anything. It's just that it is part of the scheme of things, I think.
Madam Chair and Representative Jensen, in yesterday's materials, there was a pie chart that attempted to reflect the change in the percentages of tuition. Actually, my memory is that tuition has moved from a 27% share of the pie to a 32% share of the revenue pie as... and there is one now. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Which page?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, this was Mr. Bender's slides from yesterday.
Second page of the pie charts.
Mm-hmm. Representative Jensen, did that answer your question?
I just wanted us to keep that particular pie chart in mind as we look at the whole scheme of things here. Actually, we're looking at something less than a half of the total bot dollars that flow through the community college network here. The part that we're responsible for.
Yes.
Something slightly less than a half.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many vacancies are in this way? Yeah, 46 or 46.74?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we have no vacancies.
Please continue.
We're going to move to policy packages that are part of the governor's recommended budget. I'm on slide 14, policy package 102. We've already made some mention of this, community college capital construction and construction management. As was indicated yesterday by Chair Devlin, we're not going to have a lot of conversation today, and there will be a separate hearing on Senate Bill 5514, but I did want to just remind you that it is a policy package in the budget. Slide 15, again, just denotes that the budget, the governor's recommended budget, does request $91.2 million of Article 11G bonds. That there is also $100,000 of other funds limitation for the department to manage those bonds, although it is currently empty limitation. The contribution from the colleges will be a dollar-for-dollar match, and it does not have any permanent staffing impacts on the department.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. For you or Mr. Bender, can you clarify for me, in the co-chair's apostrophe S budget, the Southern Oregon and the Rogue Community College, they took out what the governor put in there, right? So none of this we're going to look at in the community college as part of that, or we're going to understand?
Mr. Bender.
Madam Chair, members, the governor had $5.4 million of general fund as part of the funding for Southern's portion of a joint facility with Rogue Community College in downtown Medford. The co-chair's budget eliminated the $5.4 million of general fund, though they did not make any specific determination on the project itself, just that if it is to proceed under their budget plans, they do not include any general fund, which means that the project size would either have to be reduced or funding would have to come from some other source other than general fund.
So we don't have a dollar in this in the budget for that project for the bonding, is that correct?
What actually happened was typically the governor's budget would have included limitations to indicate exactly how many dollars of Article 11G bonds would be available for each of the six community college capital construction projects that are approved. However, the governor felt that these projects did not have enough information on these projects why they were being represented as costing what they do. So they put in simply dollar limitations with the understanding that at some point, as more information became known, the actual dollar limitations could be increased from $1 to whatever the actual cost of the projects would be. And there are two possibilities for that occurring. The preferred possibility would be for you as the Legislative Assembly to determine how much you wish to provide in funding for each of the for any projects that you choose to fund, and to therefore increase the $1 limitations, assuming you approve a project, to whatever that cost would be. And that is what would hopefully be the case that you would be able to do. Another possibility, however, is if you still don't feel comfortable when you're ready to sign EDI, that you know how much these projects you really want to provide funding for these projects, you would have the option of passing out the budget with the $1 limitation still intact, as long as there is sufficient authority to issue the bonds. You could say, well, we give you authority to issue so many dollars in bonds, but we don't give you authorization to spend any of the money yet. Then the colleges could come forward, and the emergency board, under its authorities, has enough authority to go ahead and increase those expenditure limitations after the session is over. But I think that you should be, my recommendation to you would be to try to get the information from the colleges so that you could make a determination as a full legislative body before the end of the session as to how much you think these projects will cost and how much funding they need from the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for, because I know we're going to have the construction, but so then maybe we need to have that once the working group, we have to make that decision, or you're saying later in the session we have to make that decision. I thought we'd have to make that decision in the working group, so we maybe need to have some more presentation on this project. But I thought the project was presented well in phase one of what the need was and what seemed like a great idea. So, again, I apologize because I know we're going to have that's going to be a special session, but since it was brought up here, I wanted to be sure I understood. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. The next policy package is on page 16. This is for the integrated data system. You have likely heard at least some about this project in both the Department of Education and the university system, as it is a shared project. The data system will connect PK through 16 student data records. I believe my understanding is that K-12 probably has the most advanced, the project is most advanced in their arena, where they already have much of the, at least the infrastructure conceived and in operation, providing student identifier numbers for students rather than their social security number. What we envision here is the building of another warehouse for data that would be primarily post-secondary. It will be built by the university system, and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development will share our data in that warehouse, and then the two data warehouses will talk. How's that for someone who is not a techie at all? It is important because right now, if you were a Chemeketa Community College and you wanted information from McNary High or South Salem High, you would have to have a paper exchange. And in some ways, in some places, there could be, in some districts, there are actual electronic data exchange, but it is not universal, and it slows down the transfer of students between and among the education sector. So we see this as a vitally important package for accelerating students, and also for knowing when they get to community college, and if they're doing well or if they're doing poorly, to know how they did in high school, so a conversation can be had with the high school about the preparedness of students, and likewise with the university system as community college students transfer. How do they do? Right now we do a lot of data record matching. This would expedite that process, and it really, I believe it's both for ease of student movement. It is also a large piece of accountability for the education sectors about how we are doing and how well students are learning.
Representative Jensen and then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand, I think, all of the stakeholders in this data collections motivations and needs. I suspect that they're all defensible. The thing that concerns me about this is the more of this that we do, the more of the Big Brother syndrome that we have. And I have to admit that I'm always nervous about these types of things. As a consequence, I think on my check sheet it didn't come up with a very high recommendation. As it is now, if I want, or as it has been, if I want you to, as an institution, to know about my past record, I get my past record and have it sent on to you. It seems to me the potential is there to take me out of it and have my record floating around somewhere amongst all of the institutions that might. And I am admittedly nervous about this request. Understanding what its value is.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, the point person in the department on this particular project is Connie Green, and I think that she might best be able to respond to your question about what is envisioned and protections for the individual.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, for the record, my name is Connie Green, and I work with the Department of Community College and Workforce Development. The information from students, currently you have it sent. You put a request to the high school, you put in a written request to the Community College or to the Oregon University System. This would be an electronic request. I still have to release my information to move, but now it can move quickly between the information versus waiting for someone to process it, physically process it. Once it gets there, so for us, it's really helping the student get information, get more quickly there, and they still release it. The information about learning and accountability, it's all in aggregate. So if we could figure out that if we happen to have a committee of learners, maybe the all of you, and if we could identify who you were, we could not release that. Our hope is to have the aggregate six or more, and you cannot tell who they are, but the goal is to get information back to a English teacher at a high school that the student she taught in 2002 succeeded this way at Chemeketa, this way at Oregon State in these kinds of classes, or did not, percentage-wise. So trying to get information back to teachers to improve and for educational system to improve. So the data warehouse lets the student more quickly get their information, but it also lets us aggregate information and give it back to improve learning. We have the same concern about Big Brother, and we also have to follow the FERPA, the Federal Information Act, of how we handle student records, the Family Privacy Act. And so we're really cautious of all those things, Representative Jensen, trying to put all those protections in up front.
It's certainly laudable that we want to find some way to improve this English teacher's instruction. And, you know, I would appreciate that. So I don't know that that I'm comfortable having my records, you know, identified as one Bob Jensen did such and such at Chemeketemi Community College and such at the University of Oregon. Now, why did you, you know, with one Bob Jensen? It's okay that a student, you know, had this type of experience, but I don't know that I need that identification to do what you want to do, or what I think you're asking or saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, we do not want to identify you and your learning pattern or Mr. Bender's. What we do want to do is make sure your record is transferred when you want it to electronically. The moment we get to the research part, you would not know who the person was. It is an aggregate. So we'll know about the class, the people you taught writing 121 to in this kind of year. Here's how they did when they went to take writing 200 somewhere else. It's that broad level.
Senator Nelson? I'm sorry. Were you?
I wanted that information as such on the record that what the intent is here, so that we know on down the road what the intent was and how it was to be set up and used, so there's no chance for some deviation from that.
Thank you, Representative Jackson. Senator Nelson.
It's just a question. K through 12 has a $1.8 million database thing. Is this connected with this $800,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, what they have done so far is they're providing the student unique identifiers as for students who are coming out of the K-12 system, and their investment here is to make sure that works for all of their high schools. I believe they have a separate budget package beyond this, which is really looking at the whole K-12 system, which we call horizontally across all high schools, all K-12 school districts, and they're looking at how to align those in a better way. That's a separate issue. This is just how to get someone going from it's the vertical, how to get going from a high school to college to OUS or back. So there are two separate packages going here.
Just I'll follow up on that, I guess. But do we have any, is there a performance measured based on this thing? So, I mean, is it actually being used? And does it have any benefit? I mean, that's what our charge is. I mean, you can say it has some benefit, but I mean, if I was an instructor, I probably don't have time to really study this. I mean, I'm too busy teaching. Why? How is it going to benefit me as an instructor? I don't make that connection.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, currently one of the things we know in education is that you do your teaching in your classroom, you do the very best you can do, no matter what level it is. Oftentimes the connections, though, about what the students learn in that classroom and the rigor and the information of that, how it prepares them, is one of the areas that it appears that in education throughout the United States and through a lot of national surveys and different groups have said, you know what, we don't have that clearly. So I can be a great teacher in my classroom, but if I don't connect and really prepare the person for the next learning, how does that connect? So I think we've been working very hard in education to find ways to make that learning connected. Florida, Texas, and other states have very comprehensive systems, and it is making a difference. They're giving the information back to the classroom. Oregon would like to do the same. So it's not being a leader in this. It's really trying to catch up with other states how they're improving their learning. And so classroom teachers are using it if you can provide it in a way that says your students that you taught here did very well or here's some gaps, here's the percentage that didn't do well, and lets you begin to look at what it is you are teaching and how it connects.
Senator Nelson also asked, though, about a performance measure directly tied to this piece of the work, the integrated data system.
We currently, if you have seen our performance measures, and we currently are trying to, in fact, yesterday Commissioner Brawley talked about the number of individuals in post-secondary education and the gap that we have, talked about the number of individuals with literacy needs and the gap that we have. We have performance measures about learning. This will help us actually improve why aren't we meeting it, and can we get information back into the system to actually improve those measures we already have? So we didn't think of putting a new performance measure in. It was to improve the ones we have so people can continue that learning process and increase that capacity.
So I think I share Representative Jensen's concerns. I quite haven't got it all fitted together in my mind now.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just ask Mr. Bender, when we do the construction conversation on page 15, that we discuss the $100,000 for the construction program management. Be sure that we understand what that's. I understand the insurance, but the management role, please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to move on then to policy package 104. The department did request, and you will find in the governor's recommended budget three additional positions. These three positions are funded with federal and other funds, and I would like to walk through them with you. In your handout, you will see a box on the left-hand side, Executive Support, Specialist 2. This is a position that we currently have as limited duration. It is in support of the Statewide Workforce Investment Board. We have had this, the state is required to have a statewide investment board. Last biennium, you approved the executive staff as a regular position in the department, and we have had support for that board, and it, which is also one of our legislative packages that we will discuss later, that this person does support that 40-plus member board and their meetings and the committee structure and the executive staff. And our request was, and it was approved by the governor's office, to move it from limited duration to a regular employee. Okay. And it would be fully federally funded through WIA. The second position is in the second left, coming from the left-hand column. Mm-hmm. That's a procurement and contract specialist. During the past 2 years, both state and federal compliance audits of the department have identified that we have insufficient staff, which have resulted in some internal weaknesses, control weaknesses. We believe that the addition of this position will help us with those to strengthen our fiscal and accountability systems and operation. It would provide, this position would provide technical work in administering legally sufficient procurement and award functions. I would say in the last biennium, with the onset of the Employer Workforce Training Fund, our contract and procurement responsibilities have at least tripled. We have had thought that we were well able to shoulder the responsibility of an additional, we already had that $6 million that went for the Employer Workforce Training Fund, but we have learned in probably in the school of hard knocks that when you have $4 million that is distributed to the locals and you're still left with $2 million, and each of them is almost each and every project, and I think I could say that there are upwards of 20 separate projects and probably more than that. Each one needs a procurement, then each one needs a review and contract and award and then monitoring and auditing of those grants, and we simply find ourselves not at the level of customer service that we would like for the field that we represent, and this is a critical position for us to both strengthen our fiscal systems and be more responsive. And the third position is in the...
In the third position.
The third position is in the right-hand column.
That's an education program specialist. And over about the last 2 years, the department has been working with local community colleges on designing an integrated and articulated career pathway system, if you will. Pathways are aligned with recognized business and industry standards and provide adult students with a smooth and seamless transition from school to work. It is different from the work that is currently happening in community colleges in that it can be as few as 9 credits or as many as 15 in a chunk. That's my academic description of it, a chunk of curriculum. But each chunk then provides that adult learner with a stop out into a job. And when they want to come back and get the next piece of learning that will help them advance in their career, it is also not a full year. It's another chunk. And each of these chunks, as at least as I'm describing them, do have a stop out with an employer and almost always an increase in pay. In order to undertake this project, we have worked with the National Governors Association and with the Lumina Foundation and used their assistance to bring experts to the state of Oregon. So as Connie said, we aren't necessarily a leading state in this particular effort and are actually benefiting greatly from experience of other states, but we are among, there are only 8 states that are currently in this project. We feel very gratified to be a part of it, but in order to accomplish it, we really need someone at the state that's helping those 5. Right now we have 5 colleges that are engaged voluntarily in this project, and we need someone to help us with that. This position would be paid with federal resources. We had originally asked for it with general fund, but that it was replaced with federal resources, which is appropriate because we will use both federal and state general fund to fund the programs that students will access. So that is what the education program specialist in what we are terming a career pathway effort by the department.
Senator Nelson, did you wish to follow up?
Yes, if I could. This is an overall thing, and I realize this is other funds and federal funds, but I mean, I think what this committee is going to have to wrestle with is we basically have a structural breakdown of our state government of funding mechanism. We're not able to find. I don't hear anything about new taxes. I don't hear anything about tax reform. I don't see any other streams of revenue. Overall, I think we're going to have to be faced with the choice where we actually start downsizing. I know you've reorganized. You've done some really wonderful things. But I think commissioners and agency managers are going to have to at some point say, well, that was fine. We did that. That's not enough because we might get through this session and band-aid things together, but in the next session, we're just going to be back at the same problem. And how do we find those efficiencies? And I think we have to come to the agency heads to say, well, we're going to have to change this whole structure around, too. And, you know, we seem to be growing instead of maybe trying to not grow. And I mean, we're going to get to the place where we're just not going to be able to afford this. I mean, honestly. And I mean, I don't like that situation, but that's what I see the problem.
Representative March and then Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cam, I'm trying to understand the difference between the silos here. Under the Assistant Commissioner Program, you have 2 strategic team managers, and then down below, you have Education and Workforce Specialist, Education and Workforce Coordinator, 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 Coordinator. So what's the difference in the, what kind of work are the coordinators on the left doing as opposed to coordinators on the right? And then the second part of the question would come into if the Education Specialist 2 position, for example, was not federally funded, or not funded, what would happen to those federal dollars? Would they go on out into the system?
Chair Gordley, Representative March, to your first question, the education and workforce coordinators are our linkage with the both the with the stakeholders at the local level. Each of those individuals has a geographic area that they are responsible for, and for knitting together and providing both technical assistance, fiscal and monitoring services for both, for all of our programs, whether they're community college, workforce development, adult basic ed. So they have a geographic region of the state. We call them local liaisons. This is the when we reorganized, we actually moved some of our employees from moved them down and reclassed them down, and it was important for us that they all were part of the same team. Therefore, they all have the same position description and position title, and then they are responsible to us to make sure that they have their thumb on the pulse of how things are working in each of their geographic areas. An education workforce specialist would have a special program that we have identified as needing particular attention and policy analysis, particularly as we undertook with the Workforce Investment Act, moving from disaggregated services to integrated and collaborative services. We put a person in charge of helping move us to across the state, one person who had responsibility for making sure that we had a even and a more coherent set of services, and then an individual, the liaison, then had specific responsibility for an area.
So to follow up then, you're saying the, in essence, the four coordinators in the inside of the fourth column, mm-hmm. and the four coordinators in the fifth column each have geographic areas and then report to different managers.
Chair Gordley, Representative March, that is correct. The managers have expertise in not every single program, but combined the two managers have expertise of all of the programs, and so we have split the responsibility and then built an internal team.
Did you wish to follow up, Representative March?
No, just then the other part of the question was to if we didn't fund some of the one or more of the federal funded positions that are in package 104, the federal, I assume that federal money would then float on down out to the colleges.
Chair Gordley, Representative March, yes, you are correct. What we have built in the department are cross-functional teams. By and large, that's what they are. We actually think it works pretty well. I can see that you're kind of doubting our strategy here, but
well, it's just it's a different strategy.
It is different, yes.
And you know, I mean, in theory, we're you have a system, and you'd want all mm-hmm. I assume eight regions to have the same focus. So you, in theory, you know, you'd say, oh, well, they'd report to the same manager.
In theory. I would say that if the resources that are currently would be dedicated to the education program specialist for career pathways, if we did not receive the position, we would likely at least contract for some of that service outside, probably directly to a community college, and the balance of the funds would, in fact, find their way to primarily workforce investment areas, not the colleges.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Representative March, I think, clarified some of the questions that I would have with these And basically, these are not positions that, if they were not filled, that would result in an immediate reduction of either federal or other funds. The funding would be basically the same, and we would be taking from Peter to pay Paul, type of thing. And I guess the next question that comes along, that follows with that, if for some reason or another these funds that deal with some of these activities were to go away or significantly diminish, what kind of a liability is the agency setting up for us as a state for continuation of these basically civil service type positions that would then have to be coming out of general funds? I don't want to sound like if it's federal money, it's okay. But if it's general fund money, it's obviously far more important to us on this in this process, I think.
Mm-hmm. Chair Gordley and Representative Jensen, as I understand your question, let me give you an example. The department received two authority and authorization and limitation for two grants during the interim from the Department of Labor for specific projects. We did request limited duration position and said that if we did not get the limited duration position, we would not take the project. We simply don't have the resources any longer within the department to shoulder more. The money is nice. The work needs support. To directly answer your question, if the contracts and procurement process that we currently provide was to slack off, was to be reduced, we would no longer need this position. And I am not at all afraid to come to you and say, I no longer need this position. I know that's strange, but I do believe that we are very conservative in our staffing patterns and feel that we need all three of these positions. And if the work was to be reduced, we would reduce the staffing level appropriately.
I think ultimately, Representative Jensen, I think ultimately what we're trying to understand here is how these positions are tied to outcomes for the customers of the agency. So as much as you're able to relate the positions to a service that's delivered or an outcome that is delivered to the customers, I think we have a better understanding of what you're trying to convey.
Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Yes, we'll bring that information back. Thank you. On page 18, ending balances in other and federal funds, the department does maintain ending balances for other funds. Both GED and the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. That's primarily for the Youth Conservation Corps because we do each year a set of summer contracts, summer camp contracts, and so we need to be able to have them begin in June and float through until the end of summer. So there are ending balances to ensure that we have the resources for that program. Federal funds, as you note on that slide, are maintained to account for fluctuations and to make sure that we have smooth continuation year to year. slide 19, vacancies. So we have already approached this particular question put to us by Senator Nelson. We currently have no vacancies, and you see there a staffing pattern of 48 positions. Slide 20, we have two bills that the department requested, and Senate Bill 85 may have covered this in phase one, at least briefly, has passed from the Senate and has now been referred to the House Education Committee. It is a technical fix. It changes the word "and" to "or," and allowing advanced technology education and training grants to be built with public-private partnerships. And Senate Bill 187, it modifies the membership requirements of the State Workforce Investment Board, which is currently in statute. Our amendments, our bill and subsequent amendments provide for that membership to be reflective of federal legislation as the Workforce Investment Act is reauthorized. They change who must and who can serve on that board, and we have asked that our state statute just be reflective of those, be flexible enough to follow those changes and not require us to come each year and change state statute. That also has been heard at Senate Education and Workforce and has passed to the Senate to be carried by Senator Morissette. Two other pieces of legislation that you are very familiar with, that would be the two budget bills, 5506 that we are discussing today and 5514, the Community College Capital Construction Project Bill. We now would move to discussion about benchmarks and performance measures, and it would appear that we have sufficient time to do that. What we have done in the presentation materials is brought forward for your consideration the performance measure conversation that we had in phase one around the state general fund. We have added as an appendix the federal and other funds performance measures, feeling that the general fund performance measures were likely more important to this committee at this juncture. So slides 23 and 24 should be quite familiar. I'd be happy to walk through these at a level of detail that meets your needs. We are on track with our benchmarks and the targets that are set, with the exception of goal number 3. And that is that all Oregonians have access to excellent, affordable community college services. And I know that you may believe that this horse is dead, but I'll beat it a little more, that Oregon is not particularly affordable when it comes to community college tuition.
We're not trying to beat the horse. We're trying to revive the horse.
That's exactly right.
So let's just kind of shift our thinking if we might.
Or maybe just beat it up so it'll run.
That's right. Prod that horse up.
You know, I'm just speaking from my own personal position here. Settling for mediocrity is unacceptable.
Thank you.
I'm sure just a question.
Senator Nelson.
Sorry, I mean, I'm going back to that data thing. You have $800,000. Would you rather have that in tuition increases or in collecting data if you had to make the choice? I mean, that's kind of where we're at.
Chair Gordley, Senator Nelson, I think you raise an important question, and I don't want to look around at the audience. I dare say they would absolutely love to have $800,000. Splitting it 17 different ways would likely help a handful of students. We anticipate that the construction of this integrated data system will in the long term help many more students and with their transfer and acceleration between the education systems.
Not a fair question. we're not in a fair situation either. I mean, but we have to make that choice at some point.
I would like to direct your attention to slide 25. This is the Community College Performance Indicators. We, as I said, we did go through these in phase one. We did build these performance measures in 2001 with the help of legislative leadership. We have tracked them against the baseline year in most cases of 98, 99. This is what we term our four A's, the accessibility, affordability, adaptability, and accountability. And we have prepared here, and in phase one you actually received our I think a trifold or bifold display of each of these measures. And it does separate them into access and affordability, and those would be the student goals. Adaptability, ensuring that the community's workforce development needs are being met. If you move on to slide 26, there's the list of the accountability goals. Both quality goals and what I would term access goals and service goals. You have an interest in going deeper, or shall we move to the co-chair's performance measures?
Questions or comments from the members? Let's go to the co-chairs.
Okay.
And that's the one pager we have in front of us?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
On the next number of slides, we have listed on slide 27 the performance measures and program priorities that the co-chairs forwarded. We skipped over the number one that's on your page because we did bring information back to the committee. So the number one here, modification of measure 586-2 to measure youth, is the number two, just in case I don't want to have us be lost in this process before we start. So if you were to move to slide 28, what we have tried to do is group the request for additional performance measures, or at least additional information on each of these performance measures thematically. So the percentage, we're going to begin with those that measure education, and that is number, your number five, our number four, the percentage of community college students who transfer to the Oregon University system and their progress. You will see on slide 28 greater detail in response to that question. If we were to look at the 2001-02 cohort of community college students, 16,700 enrolled in an OUS institution in the next year, 11,000 or 14.7% of those students were in lower division collegiate. Okay, the grade point average of this cohort was 2.99.
Okay.
Representative Jensen?
I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're trying to tell me in this. 16,000 were enrolled in OSU institution, 11,000 of the above 16,000, I assume, were lower division transfer.
Right.
Where are the others?
Getting a little prompt over here, I'm sorry. Chair Gordley, Representative Jensen. I could wing an answer to your question, but I would prefer not to and bring back a concrete answer. My assumption is that these are students that were registered at the community college taking lower division collegiate coursework. Not all of transfers would have been. They could have been in professional, technical, or in other, you know, in other program categories. But certainly it appears that the majority of the students were enrolled in lower division collegiate that made that transfer. And I'm going to work on the percentage because that simply cannot be right. 14.7% cannot be a depiction of 11,000 into 16,000.
It strikes me that maybe that's...
It's backwards. 74.1.
Yeah, it might be exactly reversed.
It's two-thirds.
Yes. It's more like, yes.
No, but it strikes me that maybe as a factor of the total number of students enrolled, I don't know. Okay.
Again, Chair Gordley, Representative Wendt Jensen, I don't know either, and I'll find out and bring that back.
Thank you.
Two questions. One, are you also proposing targets for the new performance measures?
Madam Chair, I would be happy to propose targets for the committee to consider, yes.
All right. And then also, I think we also need to look at... because one of the things we're also trying to track is the progress of students by gender, race, ethnicity, again, going to access, and what does that look like overall. You need to do some further disaggregation of the information that's being requested by the co-chairs. If you follow what I'm
yes,
asking.
Yes, I do, and we will make that so.
Just so that we're being consistent overall in how we're tracking. Great. And where would you like to go next?
I'm going to move along to
Representative Benson.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. If I could ask, when you're running down the other information on item four, if you'd do the some clarification for me on the second and third bullets, too.
Would you like that now, Representative?
Well, if, you know, that would be fine, but I'm having a little trouble distinguishing all of this, too. First of all, I don't know. 71.7% graduated from what? From who? Is that 71.7% graduated from the two-year school? 71.7% graduated from the university with a baccalaureate degree? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, yes. This is a reporting of the number of students who received a baccalaureate who were part of the 97-98 cohort.
The number of students that we know, it in no way accounts for the number of those students who would have gone out of state or to private schools.
Correct.
And then the 97-98 community college students, regardless of community college credits earned, 55.8%, I guess that would be the same thing. So that's about one.
I do have another thought. If we are successful in passing Senate Bill 300, expanded options, what would you recommend as a performance measure to track? I'm going to ask you to look at a performance measure that would track that progress of high school students moving into community colleges.
Madam Chair, I certainly think that we can benchmark our last several biennium effort and look at the number that are currently transferring and are accumulating credit and successful in transfer to bring back a proposed target.
Excellent. We have about 7 minutes remaining.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to just forge ahead here. on the next item. I think what we want to tell the committee is that, by and large, the performance measures that have been proposed by the co-chairs are doable. And these, I regret that I didn't begin there with this set of slides. We have disaggregated them to show you that we have the information and can report it. You're now in this dialogue requesting further detail, which is just fine. But the overall statement is that with the exception of the Small Business Development Center measure, which we are working with the director, Bill Carter, and with co-chair Schrader to talk about exactly how to propose and measure what I think the co-chair is actually after for small business development centers, we are able to report back to you on these performance measures that were proposed. So quickly, slide 29 is the number and percent of nursing completers. We have historically given you a percentage of passage rate. The question here is, that's great, but how many took it? And as compared to how many passed? Item number six is a finer cut of the actual Oregon and national pass rates for specific licensing and certification tests. So you can see that we have begun the work to identify those. The next set of measures fell under, in our thinking, under employment. The request was to measure employment success for at-risk youth, and we currently obtain employment from employment measures from our federal measures, but we also were asked to report not just the whole number, but the percentage. Item number five, employment for success for students completing community college programs. Right now, many, I think that better than 85% of community college students are working while they are attending community college. This is a difficult measure for us to discern those who aren't working, or if they were working, did they then receive a better job? We are in conversation with the employment department to use unemployment wage records to match our two databases. But right now, it will either overstate or understate what the reality is, given that so many community college students are part-time students and full-time workers. So we'll.
One of the things that strikes me about item one is that it really doesn't speak to the quality of employment. Employment that is a living wage job is one thing. Mm-hmm. A minimum wage job is quite something else. I think that's another piece that we need to refine.
Thank you, Chair. Gordon. On page 31, item number 7, another employment measure. There was a request that the employment success of clients participating in workforce programs be disaggregated into the following categories, and that we provide employment rates. These are measures that we report federally, and so we are we bring forward that information for you. We do currently, as I have indicated, use some of the Workforce Investment Act funds for incumbent workers, and we are currently gathering data on those individuals that they are already working. So employment data is really a misnomer. We are looking, though, at wage gain for those individuals, but that is a project that is underway and not yet complete. Get that information. Slide 32 is reiteration, really, that we already do provide or already do collect this information and can certainly provide it. And the U.S. Department of Labor does not require a match for any of their programs. Business development. This is the small business development center measure that I was alluded to earlier. As I said, we are working on comparative data so that we can get to business startups and sales comparing Oregon to other states. So that is work that is ongoing. So that brings us to our summary with 2 minutes to go. Just want to leave you with the thoughts, and I'm certain that my rendition may well pale in comparison to the testimony that you heard both on Tuesday of this week and last evening in your public hearing. But accessibility is key, and if post-secondary education is not accessible, then we won't have citizens that are able to compete locally, regionally, and globally. Affordability in Oregon is slipping away. We cannot continue to be a leader in higher education if we can't have our citizens accessing post-secondary education. And last but not least, post-secondary education and training does lead to better economic life for the individual, for the community, and for the state. This is a cycle of investment because it does have benefits for us all. And the last couple of slides are slides you have seen before that talk about how accessibility has declined in the last two biennia, how affordability has also declined in the last two biennia. I know like that grade F troubles me considerably. That higher learning does equal higher earning. And I just wanted to finish with this quote from the League of Innovation. In the 21st century, America's ability to educate its people will increasingly determine its economic competitiveness as the country shifts from industrial to an information economy. And I want to thank you for your kind attention and your thought-provoking and sometimes difficult questions, and look forward to continued dialogue with you about investment in Oregon's community colleges.
Thank you. Thank you all. Any closing comments? Senator Nelson? Go ahead, Representative.
I just had one question and a follow-up from before. Do community colleges try to maintain any records of students transferring out of state private universities or private colleges? I think that in some areas, and I'm thinking of one in particular, somebody goes to a community college for physical therapy. You know, they get lost in our evaluation of transferring on because we don't have a real physical therapy university, you know, in the state. I mean, we have private schools, but not a public school. And at Blue Mountain, I know my students, and I had several of them, perhaps for religious affiliations, but wound up going to Loma Linda. Which, you know, then I understand also that's years ago, but that same data would be seemingly being kind of lost here or not accounted for here, which is a strong point, again, for community colleges and that thing.
Well, before you leave that subject, Chair Gordley, Senator Representative Jensen, the state of Oregon and the department has pursued association and membership in something called the National Clearinghouse, and that clearinghouse will look at Oregon transfer students outside of the state to both public and private. And we are beginning, we have had colleges who have been, community colleges in Oregon that have been members of the clearinghouse, but not statewide. So we made the decision that we needed to be a statewide member so that we could have data that included all 17 colleges and where students where students went after they left a community college. That association has just begun. I would expect that we will have some fairly robust data for you when we return.
I really appreciate the department's, moving forward on that, because I do think it's an important piece of data for us to look at, that we miss, a number of success stories, if you wish, when we don't take that area into consideration.
Absolutely.
Thank you, and thank the department for doing
that. Senator Nelson, did you have a closing comment?
Yeah, quickly, I think Portland Community College did a great job last night. But I was going back to your summary, accessibility and affordability. One of the guys that testified was a single father raising three children. Said, "You want me in the education system? You want me in the prison system?" He didn't say anything about data. And so when I think we get down to make that choice, I'm gonna come down on his side. And the data might be nice, but it's more necessary for him to go to school.
Okay. And cheaper.
Right. Yeah. The prison, by the way, is just not even a mile away, right down State Street. Keep things in perspective. Thank you so very much. We appreciate your hard work and always your professionalism. Thank you. We're adjourned.